On June 1, 2002, in a speech at West Point, President Bush set out a bold, some say brash, revision of U.S. foreign policy. The attacks of 9/11, he said, showed that the United States could no longer afford to stand idle as threats gathered overseas. In the future, the president said, he would take action to preempt terrorism. Preemption has long been U.S. policy. It's part of any country's right to defend itself. But no president had ever made it so prominent or so public. To critics, this Bush doctrine represented a radical departure, an excuse for aggression. Supporters said the policy was an entirely appropriate response to 9/11 and the now demonstrated capacity of stateless terrorist groups to inflict mass casualties in the United States. Less than a year later, President Bush would describe Iraq as a gathering threat to the United States and the world and put his policy into action. Today, the report of the 9/11 Commission vividly describes the consequences of the failure to take decisive action against al-Qaeda before September the 11th, while the report of the Senate Intelligence Committee earlier this month just as vividly describes how much of the president's justification for the war in Iraq, the extent of links to al-Qaeda and stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons, was the product of bad intelligence. In your mind, where should the bar for preemption be set now? How should 9/11 and Iraq affect public, congressional, and international support? Can we afford to wait until it's certain and a threat is imminent before taking action, or do we need to be more proactive and seek out dangers before they're at our doorstep? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. With us here in Studio 3A is Tom Donnelly, a resident fellow in defense and national security studies at the American Enterprise Institute, the author, most recently, of Operation Iraqi Freedom, A Strategic Assessment. Good of you to join us.
Thank you, Neil.
And also with us is John Mearsheimer, professor at the University of Chicago, the author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. He's with us from Chicago, and good to have you on the program as well.
Glad to be here, Neil.
Professor Mearsheimer, let's start with you. Has the war in Iraq changed your mind about what the standard we should use to justify preemption?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between preemption and preventive war. The Bush administration likes to argue that the war in Iraq was a preemptive war, but in fact, it was a preventive war. If it was a preemptive war, nobody would have argued against it. And let me tell you what the difference is. A preemptive war is where you have evidence that the other side has both the capability and the intention to come after you. They're about to attack, and you strike first. You get in the first blow. That's preemption. And nobody would argue against preemption. Preventive war is very different. With preventive war, the other side has maybe the capability, but no clearly demonstrated intention, or maybe the intention, but not the capability. But you think there's a long-term threat here. And what you do is you attack the other side before that threat materializes. That's a preventive war. The United States before Iraq had never launched a preventive war. This was the first case of that. And that is what is terribly controversial.
Tom Donnelly, is that a semantic difference?
No, I think actually John's distinction is not only a crucial one, but I would basically accept his terminology. Where I have the problem is the application of that distinction to Iraq. And that's certainly not the case that the Bush administration made. In fact, Condoleezza Rice went out of her way to say this is neither a preventive nor a preemptive war, but in fact was a continuation of a conflict that had long roots and was based in Saddam's flouting of UN resolutions and so on and so forth. But again, I don't want to make this a discussion entirely about Iraq. And I would say that the strategic attractions of preemption are as vivid as they were in the immediate aftermath of 9/11.
So what are the standards for when you should strike, Tom Donnelly?
The key term here is the question of imminence. And the question is, under today's strategic circumstances, facing the kind of enemy we face amongst the terrorists and amongst the states in which they live, what is your definition of an imminent attack? And the leap of imagination that couldn't be made prior to September 11th was whether al-Qaeda in Afghanistan under the leadership of the Taliban met that threshold test. And I think to our great sorrow, we learned that, again, in the 21st century and in an age where nuclear weapons in particular are more readily available to these kinds of folks, that imminence no longer means an army massed on the border with tanks pointed toward the enemy capital.
John Mearsheimer, a lot of the discussion in the before the 9/11 commission was frustration with the lack of military options against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, that I think there were three separate opportunities that were offered where they said there might be an opportunity to strike, but given the possibilities of collateral damage, civilian casualties, that people decided it wasn't worth the risk.
But if the United States had attacked Afghanistan, had attacked Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, that would have been a preemptive war, and few people would have quarreled with that, because the fact of the matter is he had both the capability and the intention of coming after us, and there was no fight there. And the same thing was true with regard to the war in Afghanistan. Very few people said that the United States should not go into Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban and to go after Osama bin Laden. Iraq is a very different case. Contrary to what Tom says, Iraq was not an imminent threat. Many of us argued that before the war. It's perfectly clear now that the war is over with and we haven't found any weapons of mass destruction. We found virtually no evidence that Iraq was collaborating with al-Qaeda. It wasn't an imminent threat, and there was no need to go to war. And what's happened here is that we've got ourselves into a huge tar pit. We're probably going to lose the war in Iraq. We've made the terrorism problem worse, and we've done very little to deal with North Korea and Iran, which are actually more dangerous threats than Iraq.
Has Iraq reduced the possibility or the realities of preemptive strikes, should they ever become necessary, against places like North Korea or Iran? Tom Donnelly?
Well, we're jamming so many issues together that I think we're really getting confused here. Again, one can argue against the wisdom of the Iraq War and set the question of preemption or prevention entirely aside. And it may be true that the difficulty of reconstructing Iraq or securing the victory, or however you want to define what's happened over the past year, may indeed reduce the appetite for American political leaders and the American people more broadly to get involved in wars in the Middle East. But that doesn't bear on North Korea or Iran, mm-hmm. in which case you run up against a pretty classic case of nuclear deterrence, with the United States being the object of deterrence. So, you know, we're going to really have a hard time if we jam all these issues into the same basket, and we'll end up being confused if we try to imagine that Iraq, North Korea, Iran, and Afghanistan are manifestations of the same phenomenon.
But Tom, think about what President Bush said when he gave his famous Axis of Evil speech. He said that Iran, North Korea, and Iraq were all part of the same problem. And in effect, that the doctrine of what he called preemptive and I call preventive war would apply to all three of them. One would think if you're going to go to war against Iraq, you'd certainly want to go to war against Iran and North Korea. But the fact of the matter is the United States has no intentions of going to war against either one of those countries. And in the meantime, North Korea is in the process of building more nuclear weapons, and Iran is racing down the road to acquire nuclear weapons. Yet we're not going to do anything. All of that tells me that the president's doctrine of preemptive or preventive war, whatever you want to call it, has basically washed up on the rocks in Iraq.
It means that when a state like this gets nuclear weapons, or you think they have nuclear weapons, and furthermore, the prospect of conventional war in North Korea or in Iran is pretty unappetizing in and of itself, you may want to try to constrain the effects, and you still may regard these guys as your enemies, but it doesn't make going to war in kind of a suicidal way doctrinally advisable. These wars are distinct. The enemies are different in each case. And we might easily have been deterred by North Korea or Iran, even if neither state had nuclear weapons.
John Mearsheimer, when does a threat that calls for preventive measures transform into a need for preemption?
Well, I'm not against preemptive war. For example, in early December 1941, if we had detected the Japanese aircraft carriers headed towards Pearl Harbor, I would have been all in favor of attacking them before they attacked Pearl Harbor. There's nobody who's going to argue against a preemptive war. The question is, when do you launch a preventive war? And my argument is that it's very hard to make a case for preventive war, in large part because the cost of those wars is usually much greater than the benefits that you achieve. This was the problem in Iraq. If you could have gone in to Iraq, or you could go to Iran and North Korea today and win the war easily and quickly and cheaply and then get out, most people would be in favor of doing that. But launching wars in the modern world is a very costly and very dangerous business. So the costs invariably outweigh the benefits when you talk about preventive war. And therefore, you have to have very special circumstances. The only one I can think of off the top of my head, at least at a general level, is where you had someone who you thought was a certifiable lunatic in charge of a country that had weapons of mass destruction, and you had good reason to think that there was some reasonable chance that person would use those weapons against you. Then I think a preventive war would make good sense.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Aaron, who joins us from Jackson, Michigan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, we're talking about preemption in terms of, like, if somebody's imminently attacking us. What about considering using preemption or preventative war in terms of preventing genocides, like in Sudan or like in the situation in Liberia? Because it seems to me that would go a lot farther in terms of helping the situation.
Indeed, talk today from Prime Minister Blair of Britain about the use of British forces possibly in Sudan. A reaction from the government of Sudan saying this would not be a good idea. Tom Donnelly.
I think that's we're going to have a lot more conversations about Sudan over the coming months, and perhaps this is going to be a better test of genuine preemption, excuse me, than perhaps Iraq was. And if I could make one further comment about something John said earlier, one thing the 9/11 Commission has told us is how difficult it was for any American political leader to imagine a preemptive war against Afghanistan prior to 9/11. There's no doubt that al-Qaeda wanted to kill Americans, and, you know, that was part of the 9/11 panel's report, too, was that there were many warnings that suggested that these guys were our enemy. And the necessary, the thing that was missing in that equation was the imagination to conduct a genuinely preemptive war in the classic sense, you know, al-Qaeda is like an army posed at
political,
the border.
Political will as well. This was the Clinton administration for most of this time, and there were objections that Clinton was wagging the dog when he fired the missiles at al-Qaeda.
And the same is true of the Bush administration. Prior to 9/11, nobody in the Bush administration thought that going to war in Afghanistan was a good thing. This is famously the graveyard of empires, and we should remember how difficult it was simply to get to the point where we were willing to go to war in Afghanistan, because that was regarded as a really unappetizing prospect.
Aaron, thanks very much for the phone call.
You bet.
We're going to continue taking more of your calls on this question when we return from a break. Our guests are John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago and Tom Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about the costs and benefits of the policy of preemption. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Monday at this time, Talk of the Nation takes a road trip on the lost highways of America. We'll be your ears. We need you. to be our eyes. If you've got a great road trip photo you're dying to share, the strangest building you've ever seen, the quirkiest road sign, email it along with your name and a one-line caption to totn@npr.org. We'll post our favorite five on our website on Monday. Today we're talking about the policy of preemption after 9/11, after Iraq. Our guests are John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago and Tom Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Professor Mearsheimer, before we get too far away from the subject of Sudan, would that qualify as a preemption or humanitarian intervention or what?
It would be very different. It would be a humanitarian intervention. There you would not be going to war for strategic purposes. Preventive war and preemptive war are all about wars that involve strategic calculations. A war for, say, Rwanda, a war over Sudan, those would be wars for humanitarian purposes. Very different. But the same cost-benefit calculations would apply.
Tom Donnelly?
Yeah, look, I think we may begin to view the situation in Sudan as more strategic than simply humanitarian. This is a radical Islamic government that has harbored Osama bin Laden, that brokered some sort
also of... Also kicked him out.
Well, but also brokered... Look, I mean, their connection to radical Islamic movements, to the philosophy of bin Ladenism, if you will, is pretty well established. The immediate effects have been felt by the Sudanese people, alas. But this is a regime that has, where all the elements that go for, that make preemption attractive come into play. It's also got something of a great power sponsor in the form of the People's Republic of China. And it is a link on the expansion of radical Islam from the Arabian Peninsula into the African continent. So if we're genuinely thinking strategically about radical Islam and violently anti-American Islam, you come very quickly back to the question of Sudan and to treat it more strategically. It's a problem of the government in Khartoum, not of, you know, a natural disaster like an earthquake or a hurricane.
So, but where does the question of imminence come into that? Where's the threat?
Well, I wouldn't say that we are at that brink yet, but if we want to, first of all, to stabilize the genuine humanitarian crisis that's going on there, we have to understand the political context in which that is occurring. There are also links between the government in Khartoum and other terrorist organizations that extend even farther west and farther north in Africa. This is part of the larger puzzle.
Let's get another caller in. Christina is with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm sorry for mangling your name there.
It's okay. My question was, should we take responsibility to remove every corrupt leader that we think may be a threat to us? Or I believe in this case, and basically the intentions of Bush were, I don't exactly think they had weapons of mass destruction. I'm not really educated to know that for sure. I don't think anyone is right now, but there were a lot of rumors that Saddam had other things. He was murdering people and, you know, mm-hmm. at the drop of a hat. Where do we cross that line where it's our responsibility, you know, humanitarily, and how do we know, you know, we are a world power, but does that give us the right?
Good question. Tom Donnelly?
Very good question. Also, amended to that should be who has the responsibility. Look, I would say that the political corruption of the Islamic world, broadly speaking, has been the phenomenon that has produced radical Islam, bin Ladenism, if you will. And
many would argue the U.S. played a large role in that.
Well, look, we have a role in the region. We've always had a role in the region. We will continue to have a role. It is a region of strategic importance to us and to the rest of the world. It would be nice if we could just somehow walk away from it and let them stew in their own juices, but that's more problematic, it seems, than trying to solve this problem. But again, I would say that for the foreseeable future, we're going to be doing more rather than less, and there will be more opportunities for us. And again, we will be tempted, certainly, to think about taking preemptive military steps in this region of the world because we greatly fear the consequences of leaving it unaddressed and, you know, don't want to suffer from another 9/11 type event or, God forbid, a nuclear 9/11 kind of event.
Can I say a word here?
Yes, I was just going to ask you to.
I think that there's a great danger in Tom's comments in that if we're not careful here and we follow his advice, we're going to end up in a war with the entire Islamic world. He talks about the political corruption of the Islamic world as if this entire world were corrupt. He talks about using military force in places like Sudan and says that we're going to be more involved, not less involved, using military force in this area of the world in the future. The end result of all this is we're going to further enrage people in the Islamic world and give them greater cause to come after us. Many people, and I would put Tom in this category, tend to think that we have a terrorism problem in the Middle East or in the Islamic world, and therefore we have to adjust our policies to deal with that. We have to become more proactive. We have to increase our military footprint in the region. In fact, they have it backwards. It's our increase in our military footprint since 1991 in the region that has caused the terrorism problem. The more we get involved in the Middle East, the more terrorism we're going to have, because terrorism is a weapon of the weak. These people cannot take us on at the conventional level. They can't even take us on at the nuclear level. So not surprisingly, they turn to terrorism. The best example to highlight the point I'm making is what happened in the mid-1980s when Ronald Reagan put troops in Beirut. He put the troops there. Terrorists struck, killed over 200 Marines. Reagan did the correct thing. He got out of Lebanon, and we had no more trouble in that region. What we did wrong after 1991 is that we left our troops in Saudi Arabia, and now we're in Iraq. If the United States thinks that it can maintain a massive military presence in the Middle East and not engender terrorism, it's simply wrong.
Let's get to another caller, and this will be Howard, and Howard's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I just have a general comment on this whole discussion of preemptive war versus preventative war, and I'm going to be kind of a radical here and say that we are not living in a new world. This is not a changed world. The old rules still apply. As the 911 Commission report says, we had a systematic failure. If everyone had been doing their job and paying attention, this would not have happened. And I'm reminded of I think it's a German military commander of last century, von Clausewitz, who said war is an extension of politics. And to me, that's if you look at politics as a continuum with a continuum with war on the far end and diplomacy, you know, getting progressively worse. What's left out of this equation here is no one's talking about diplomacy and everything you do before you attack. This whole idea that, preventative war, preemptive war, it's like the mindset now is like the Wild West. It's kind of a paranoid mindset. They're against us. I think we'll attack them. And I think we really should still look at war as a last option. I just want to bring up the ideas of von Clausewitz, where war is an extension of politics, and war should only be used as a last result.
Thanks for the call, Howard. Tom, did you want to respond to that?
I will only say that in strategy, Clausewitz is always right. but I think the caller is perhaps looking through a different end of the telescope than I am. If war is an extension of politics, then the war that's taking place in the Middle East is properly understood as an extension of the political structure in the Middle East, and I would continue to assert that that's a region that's got a whole lot of corrupt and illegitimate governments, and the essential problem is that the people who are governed by those governments don't like it all that very much, and what they don't like about the United States is its support for a variety of corrupt and illegitimate and repressive governments. So that would suggest to me that the long-term solution is, yes, of course, hopefully by means other than war, but to work for political change in a region that's going to be awash in resources because of its oil and other energy resources, but simply giving money to corrupt and illegitimate governments is way too often a recipe for violence, and as we've learned in the past 25 years or so, a recipe for American involvement, whether we like it or not.
But the fact of the matter is, Tom, the caller is correct that the United States, under the Bush administration, has privileged military force over diplomacy. We've practiced big stick diplomacy, and we've basically told people in the Arab and Islamic world.
John, we've tried to deal with Saddam and guys like that for decades and decades, mm-hmm. through diplomatic means, through all kinds of means, through limited wars even.
And we succeeded.
Well, if you're just, we have a different definition of victory here, obviously.
I don't think we're going to resolve that difference in the next few minutes. So let's get another caller on the line. Ashley's with us from St. Joseph, Missouri.
Hi. I was wondering how other countries' policies affect our decision whether or not to go to war, because we can't do these alone. And so I didn't know how the country's policies were affecting us.
I guess in a way, Ashley's asking, Professor Mearsheimer, has 9/11 Iraq, the events of the past few years, changed the formula for which of international acceptance of U.S. actions?
Well, I think Iraq has. Going into the Iraq war, the United States basically thought it could reorder the Middle East pretty much by itself. It thought that it had the military power to do that, and as I said before, it privileged military power over diplomacy. We thought that we were going to go into Iraq, win the war quickly, and then get out and move to the next target on the axis of evil. That's not proved to be the case. We're in a giant quagmire. We're in a losing war in Iraq, and we're in no position to move on to the next target. But more relevant for the question, we've now discovered that we need allies. And the Bush administration is down on its knees begging the Europeans and begging countries all around the world to provide troops for Iraq. It's gone back to the United Nations. It's found out that the United Nations might actually be helpful in Iraq. So we've gone from being very unilateralist and emphasizing military force to being much more multilateralist, to relying much more on allies. And the reason is, again, because the Bush administration's basic policy of preventive war has failed dismally in Iraq.
Look, I would just say that that's, again, I'm looking at a different reality. We're losing allies in Iraq, and part of that is because there just aren't any allies to have. There aren't a lot of militaries that can project and sustain force in the Middle East over an extended period of time. Thank God for the British and the Poles and a few others. But there is no there when you're talking about, say, French or German cooperation, thank God for the Italians. The Filipinos are pulling out and calling it a victory. Military capability still counts for a whole lot. And so there's no alliance really to be had here. They not only object to our political goals, but even if they agreed with us, there's very little military capability that they can bring or sustain to the table.
We're talking about preemptive war. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask both John Mearsheimer and Tom Donnelly to respond to a couple of emails in the couple of minutes we've got left. I was going to read them both. This from Alan Parrish in Ithaca, New York. If preemptive or preventive war would be okay if you launched it against somebody who has WMDs and has threatened to use them on you, would it be okay for North Korea to launch such an attack on the United States, a country which has WMDs and which has threatened to use them? And this one, someone along the same lines, from Lewis Williams in Charlotte, North Carolina. Are we not setting a new standard for the world? Would the Japanese attack on us not be justified on such arbitrary basis as our government has given? What do we do when others practice what we preach? We have had a good world observance rules for war for the last 60 or so years. What kind of Pandora's box are we opening? Professor Mearsheimer, why don't you respond first?
Well, first of all, we're not opening much of a Pandora's box because the United States is not going to do another one of these preventive wars for a long, long time, because, again, as I've emphasized constantly on this show, Iraq has turned out to be a disaster. So this, I think, will be the last time for the foreseeable future that we do this. With regard to countries like North Korea or other countries coming after the United States, doing to us what we do to them, that's not going to happen simply because the United States has weapons of mass destruction. And if North Korea, for example, hit the United States or any of its allies with nuclear weapons, the United States would incinerate North Korea. So North Korea will be deterred. This is why people like me argued before the war in Iraq that even if Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, even if he had nuclear weapons, he could be deterred. Now, the flip side of this is that countries like North Korea and Iran and Iraq, of course, want weapons of mass destruction. They want nuclear weapons of their own, because if they have that capability, then the United States cannot attack them. And this is why, of course, North Korea and Iran are now pursuing nuclear weapons and are not likely to give them up.
They also have regional concerns, but anyway. I wanted to give Tom Donnelly a chance to respond.
Well, it's good because I agree completely with John. You know, for most people in the world these days, the United States is the object of deterrence. They want to keep us from using our superior conventional military power to try to embark on what John regards as quixotic adventures to set them free.
Let's see if we can get another caller in just before we go. We just have a couple of minutes left. Kent is with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, hi. You may have kind of answered this, but I do want to say that I have been, am now, and will always be very supportive of the troops that are over in Iraq and the work that they're doing there. But how do we feel short term? How does the Iraq conflict and what's happened there and the mood of the country, how's that going to impact the United States' role in engaging in other types of actions of this kind?
Thanks for the call. Professor Mearsheimer, you've already said it's going to constrain any actions, such actions in the future.
It's hard to imagine the United States doing another Iraq anytime soon. We've put such tremendous stress and strain on the American military. That it's hard to see how you could use that force.
Tom Donnelly, again, did you want to come in for 10 seconds or so?
Yeah, look, it's just hard to say what the world's going to be like. The enemy gets a vote, and if there's another 9/11 type-like event, which is sadly a real possibility, how the United States would react to that circumstance, I think, is more difficult to predict.
Tom Donnelly, the author of Operation Iraqi Freedom, a Strategic Assessment from AEI Press. He joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much. And John Mearsheimer is the author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. He was with us from the campus of the University of Chicago. When we come back from a short break, the realities of implementing recommendations of Blue Ribbon panels. This is NPR News.